This podcast is from the Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky in Lexington. This craft talk by Kim Adonisio is entitled Surprise Me, Poetry and the Unexpected. Considered one of our most provocative and edgy poets, Adonisio looks at work that leads the reader to new places and some strategies for inviting surprise into your own work.
So consider that subject matter can come as a surprise, or something new can come from the subject matter. It usually happens in the process itself. Maybe you need to start out not knowing what the hell your poem will end up being about. You start with an overheard scrap of dialogue or an image that tugs at you and find your way into what your concerns really are. Or maybe you'll start out very much wanting to write about a particular memory or an anti-war poem or the taste of cold blueberries. The key is not trying to direct it too much at first. Ultimately, you've got to get in there and be the theme Nazi if you want your poem to have a theme. Just try not to overdetermine things at the beginning. Of course, if you never know where you're going, and if you never find out, no one else knows where you're going either or what you are talking about. So there's a balance. That's an important point. You may sometimes need to engineer surprise. Toni Morrison, talking about her novels, often about painful subjects like slavery and racism, said once that she had to engineer moments of lightness. If they weren't there, she had to consciously put them there. If this sounds duplicitous and manipulative, it isn't. Poetry comes from the Greek poesis, to make. As a poet, you are a maker. You're not just expressing yourself. I don't mean to say that there's anything wrong with self-expression. All art is, of course, an expression of self. But a poem requires crafting, sometimes wild, sometimes careful. Wow, life is amazing, might express what you feel, but it's in giving us an experience of that amazement in the poem itself that will compel our attention. So I want to move to performance, to the poem itself, to look at some poems and how they surprise, which I hope will be useful to you as writers as you write and revise your own work. So here are some other kinds of surprise to think about. The surprise of syntax. I think syntax is an often neglected subject in the writing of poetry, and it probably should be first. But here's an obvious example that comes to mind. Anyone lived in a pretty how town with up so floating many bells down? Huh? I don't think we say huh anymore because we know that so well. You probably got it in high school somewhere, and then we're forced to analyze it and find the Christ symbols. But which is one problem with how poetry is taught. But that wakes you up because there's something different going on. And so does this from the opening of Ginsberg's Howl, which I'm sure you know. Here are the third and fourth lines. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz. You could talk about the surprise of language here, of course. Angel-headed hipsters, that's a pretty cool word, angel-headed. Or the surprise of imagery and metaphor, the starry dynamo in the machinery of night. Those are important kinds of surprises. But what brought me up short when I looked at this passage was this. Who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking. Who says that? Isn't it usually who sat up smoking and then maybe hollow-eyed and high? But he throws in two nouns, poverty and tatters, and puts the adjectives before the verb. Who, poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high, sat up smoking? So that was something when I noticed it that was really fascinating to me. When I did this, I did a week-long workshop on syntax at a at a conference, and one of the things we did was copy the syntax of other writers. So we had to look at it and break it down and try to copy it. And what was really fascinating to me, I think we used Louise Glick, Lucille Clifton, C.K. Williams, and Ginsberg. And what the interesting thing was uniformly every single person who copied Ginsberg's syntax did something really powerful, even when their language wasn't very good. And you could see in that exercise how the energy of his poem really resided in the syntax. It was in the way he put it together. It was in the way he put together the parts of speech that gave the line all this propulsive energy. And, you know, then, of course, it helps if you have great language. But you could see it even in the people that didn't really have the language for it, whose language was sort of predictable. It was there, and it was unmistakable. So that's one way to get surprise into your work, is really to not only to kind of learn syntax, learn how the sentence is put together, learn how to write a good sentence, what makes a good sentence. And there's also, I should recommend a book by Ellen Bryant Voigt called The Art of Syntax. Some of you sound like you know it. There's a whole series called The Art Of by different writers. And you can Google it and find out. There's one by Mark Doty called The Art of Description. Several of you seem to know it. Yeah, so Bryant Voigt's book is a little bit thorny to get through, but very smart and really worth staying with. And seeing what she says about it. It will really make a difference in your writing, I think. So to invoke the same Dean Young poem again, he sometimes surprises with archaic syntax. You have to really know what you're up to so you don't sound like you're unconsciously channeling one of those canonical dead white men. And he has lines like, "Elegant are the pajamas for the voyage. Nailed the shingles to the house." So that's an odd construction that, you know, if you were to write that in an otherwise normal, normally parsed sentence or poem, it might look as though you were, I mean, people fall into this trap a lot when they're writing sonnets, say, or metrical verse. And because that used to be common practice at a certain period for writers to invert normal syntax in order to land on the rhyme, for example, or an important word, doing that today sounds as though you're not quite up to speed on the language of your time. And that's important because poetry is written in the language of its time, not of another time. But you can use it if you use it in the right way. And if you're looking for how to use it, I really recommend Dean Young, who does a lot of mixing up of diction and syntax and sort of, I guess in a way, a lot of sampling, and that's a kind of another branch of it, but really worth looking at. And how many of you know John Berryman's Dream Songs? Okay, not too many. Another great book to take a look at for how he plays with syntax, and not only syntax but tone. Really good book for that as well. So, you know, you can seek out writers who use syntactical surprise and kind of try to see what they're up to and try to fool around with your own versions of those. Okay, here's another kind of surprise, the surprise of the turn. The turn or turns in poems are big deals. They're where the poem gets to move to do something different. A poem without a turn is usually a one-note poem. I was almost going to say it's like a fish without a bicycle. Anybody remember that one? You had to be of a certain age, I think, to remember that one. But do you know what I mean by a turn? A turn is a place in the poem. It's, you know, it's commonly thought of in a sonnet where you have eight lines and then you have the turn to the next six. So you lay out some subject in the first eight lines and then you deepen it or you argue with it. A word like but or yet often appears, and then you go off in another direction or you expand on what you did before. But poems have turns and they come in different places, but they're always something that signals a move from where you started, so that, you know, maybe you suddenly something that was literal suddenly becomes a metaphor halfway through the poem. You know, you're going on about some subject and, you know, the horse trotting through the park, and you're involved in the description of the horse. And then suddenly, the way you one day, you know, and all of a sudden you're in a different world. There's a turn there now. We're not talking about the horse anymore. Now we have to reconceive that whole passage as metaphor and see what it's like. So there are lots of different kinds of turns in poems, and they're really worth both looking for and studying and in other people's work and in your own. It's a subject kind of dear to my heart right now because I'm doing a project. There's a book I also recommend called Structure and Surprise by a guy named Michael Tooney. It's spelled T-H-E-U-N-E. And he wrote this book, and I went to a panel on it at AWP one year, and I got really excited by what he was talking about, and I bought the book, and I found it to be a wonderful book. And I've been recommending it ever since. And now he and I are working on a project called Voltage Online, where we've asked a lot of different writers to write about a poem that has a really interesting or amazing turn and to write a little commentary on it. And I think we're going to launch that in late October. But it's called Voltage and Voltage Poetry. I forget. I don't even know what the URL is going to be. But it's really enlightening because I love reading people's comments on other people's poems because they really illuminate them for me a lot of times and give me a lot more than I got out of it reading it. You know, makes me go back and read it closely and to see what they found in it. I found it's really helpful. So just thought I'd mention that. So a poem without a turn is usually a one-note poem. It lays something out but never develops it, never gets to another idea, or maybe an idea at all. I love to braid my granddaughter's hair. I had a student who wrote a lovely description of doing just that. And? I said, and? But there was no and. She didn't understand why describing that wasn't yet a poem. The epiphany is the kind of surprise that has become a little bit predictable. As a structure, I think you're probably all familiar with it. James writes a blessing. People know that poem? How many people know it? Just okay, some easily Googled James Wright, a blessing, has a very surprising kind of leap at the end of the poem. Another one, a famous one, Rilke, Archaic Torso of Apollo. How many people know that? Show of hands. Okay. Another one you can easily Google, again, a very famous poem. It's a poem that in which the speaker is looking at a torso of, you know, no heads, no legs, of Apollo, and he's looking at it, and the more he looks at it, the more he feels that it's looking back at him, and the closing line is, "You must change your life," which kind of comes as a big surprise, but at the same time, it comes out of the territory of the poem, which is really about, you know, that if you look deeply enough at a work of art, it can change you. And so that's one kind of a surprise that at the end of the poem, an epiphany. There's a sudden leap. There's a sudden recognition. A leap we don't expect but have been subtly set up for. It's not a bad structure, but like your openings, pay attention to what kind of endings you typically write. You might be surprised yourself to find that you often sum things up at the end, or try to offer the lesson of the poem, or articulate what you realized after describing a certain experience. So an epiphany, it can be, as I said, it's a perfectly a wonderful way to end a poem. Many writers, including myself, do it, and often. And at the same time, I think you want to be aware of a poem that sort of goes nowhere until the epiphany, when suddenly, aha, this is what it's about, which makes it seem sort of tacked on. And you want it to really be an integral part of the poem. So I want to get to a couple poems to read you. And the first is by my co-writer of The Poet's Companion, Dorianne Locks. So it's a kind of surprise that is maybe a reversal of our expectations, and it's called This Close. This Close. In the room where we lie, light stains the drawn shades yellow. We sweat and pull at each other, climb with our fingers the slippery ladders of rib. Wherever our bodies touch, the flesh comes alive. Heat and need, like invisible animals, gnaw at my breast the soft insides of your thighs. What I want, I simply reach out and take, no delicacy now, the dark human bread I eat handful by greedy handful. Eyes, fingers, mouths, sweet leeches of desire. Crazy woman, her brain full of bees. See how her palms curl into fists and beat the pillow senseless. And when my body finally gives into it, then pulls itself away, salt-laced and arched with its final ache, I am so grateful I would give you anything, anything. If I loved you, being this close would kill me. So I think we read this poem as a love poem, but then wham, a kind of anti-epiphany. I've often asked people, why do we read this as a love poem? But everyone so far has, at least on first read. The poet surprises our... Was anybody here surprised by the last line? Did that come as a bit of a surprise? Okay. But everyone so far has, at least on first read. The poet surprises our expectations. Surely a poem by a woman of such intimacy is an expression of love. The last line turns those expectations completely upside down. Nope, it's a sex poem. It really is that. This is, for me, the answer to Sharon Olds' question in one of her poems, how do they do it, the ones who make love without love? This is how. So I'll read it to you one more time, just, you know, now that you... Did anybody know this poem before, out of curiosity? Okay. I'll read it to you one more time, just so you can sort of think about that ending and hear the poem again. In the room where we lie, light stains the drawn shades yellow. We sweat and pull at each other, climb with our fingers the slippery ladders of rib. Wherever our bodies touch, the flesh comes alive. Heat and need, like invisible animals, gnaw at my breast the soft insides of your thighs. What I want, I simply reach out and take. No delicacy now, the dark human bread I eat handful by greedy handful. That feeling about that line might have changed. Eyes, fingers, mouths, sweet leeches of desire. Crazy woman, her brain full of bees, see how her palms curl into fists and beat the pillow senseless. And when my body finally gives into it, then pulls itself away, salt-laced and arched with its final ache. I am so grateful I would give you anything, anything. If I loved you, being this close would kill me. So kind of interesting. I think it's kind of a transgressive poem in that way. Just for women to write frankly about sex, I think, is something that's still pretty rare. And I always thank Sharon Olds for being the writer who at least gave me permission, as I read her work, to do that, to go those places that I didn't know poems could go at the time, because I was just starting to write. And I had no idea you could say things like that in poetry. And after I read her, I said, oh, I guess, you know, I immediately sat down and wrote a poem about teenage sex, you know, because I felt like I could, that was actually territory that poetry could explore. And so that's just a poem that I always think about for that surprise at the end, and for the way that when you go back and read it with that ending in mind, you can sort of see that that is what it says. But I think the poet knows that we're going to read it a certain way, you know, until that ending. So here's another poem that delivers a big surprise. This is The Rose by Jean Valentine. The Rose, a labyrinth, as if at its center God would be there. But at the center, only rose, where rose came from, where rose grows. And us, inside of the lips and lips, the likenesses, the eyes, and the hair we are born of, fed by, and merry with. Only flesh itself, only its passage, out of where, to where. Then God the Mother said to Jim in a dream, "Never mind you, Jim, come rest again on the country porch of my knees." Here's where Bobby gave me the perfect segue. Emily Dickinson's famous formulation that she knew poetry when she felt as though she was being trepanned, to amend her slightly. Do you guys know what trepanning is? It was an ancient practice of, it was actually sort of, you know, primitive brain surgery. They would open the back of the skull as a way to, I let the demons out, I guess. I don't know exactly, but that was trepanning. It was always a concept that fascinated me. So Emily Dickinson's famous formulation that she knew poetry when she felt as though she was being trepanned, to amend her slightly, isn't always reliable. Sometimes I've found it's an overall chill or burning, and sometimes it's my heart being scoured out or drop-kicked into eternity. In the case of Valentine's The Rose, though, I have to go with Dickinson. When I first read this poem, I felt as though I'd been whacked with a 2x4. The gorgeous fragment of the labyrinth presents an essential question, maybe the essential question, after setting aside the possibility of a creator. Presents, that is, the mystery. We're taken down into rose, into womb, ultimately to nothing, the nothing out of which something comes. At the center of the labyrinth, only passage, only rose, the sheer fact of it, tender, brute fact. In those 12 lines, filled with the call and response of nouns and rhymes and syntax, we're held inside contemplation and wonder, and perhaps dread. Who are we? Where are we going? What's the point of it all? And I just want to read the opening again for you so you can listen. I'm going to read the opening, the first stanza, so you can listen to all the echoes, all the repetition in this very short passage. One thing to notice is that it's a fragment. It's not a full sentence. She jumps right in with a labyrinth. She doesn't say it's like a labyrinth or it looks like a labyrinth. She just begins with this fragment, so it's sort of suspended in air, the whole thing. And there's a lot of parallel constructions, speaking of syntax, out of where rose came from, where rose grows. A lot of that going on in this very short fragment. A labyrinth, as if at its center God would be there, but at the center, only rose, where rose came from, where rose grows, and us inside of the lips and lips, the likenesses, the eyes, and the hair we are born of, fed by, and merry with. Only flesh itself, only its passage, out of where, to where. And here comes the 2x4. A radical shift in tone and diction, the fragment and questions dissolving into a single declarative sentence. The poem seems simply to rupture. What happened to that profound suspended moment? Weren't we ready for a bit of existential wisdom, maybe a further profound question? That's what a more predictable poet might deliver at this point. But no, we leave it all behind with the word then. Now we're in the narrative universe, with God showing up after all to offer a bit of good old reassurance. Have we wandered by accident into another poem? Did the contemplative questioner go off her meds? Or come down from the hallucinogenic drugs she took with the South American shaman? And who the hell is Jim? What Valentine does is to offer an answer to the unanswerable, that a certain kind of person could take as solace, an answer that seems to me a critique of that solace. Here's Jim, back in his loving mother's arms. Never mind you about those big issues, honey. Gosh darn that labyrinth. Let me make you some cookies. In Hemingway's word, isn't it pretty to think so? And yet, what I love is that I kind of want to buy that cheesy little tchotchke. Don't we all want the solace, if not of religion, then of memory? Aren't we creatures of nostalgia because we truly need it sometimes? My own mother died this year. She was never no country porch, but in occasional dreams, there she is, my source, the lips from which I came. Out of where? To where? God the Mother. If I could climb into her arms again, I would. Some of her ashes are in a Ziploc in my kitchen. If I can have her back in a dream, I'll take her. This, too, is in that turn for me. I'll have it both ways. Thank you very much. That little section on the rose is actually the essay I wrote for Voltage Poetry because I was so fascinated by that poem and that turn. So if you're interested, you'll be able to read it online sometime later in the fall. So what other kinds of surprises can you engineer? Line breaks. Everybody's probably familiar with the surprise you can achieve by the line where the line says one thing, but by the next line, it's said something different, so you get to get that two-in-one effect from where you break your line. And metaphor, of course, the unexpected comparison. Think about it on both the local level, like line break and metaphor, and on the level of structure, that is, the turn. Where in your poem can you take a left turn and go someplace different? Look for those opportunities in your poem. Look to see if your poem has a turn or turns, and if so, where that occurs. And if you don't find one, engineer one. So that's really what I have to say about the turn, and I just want to close with some Dorothy Parker poems, which I admire for their deft and usually late surprises. Often they're ironic turns. And they go back to, you know, the real pleasure of surprise, too, and the delight that we take in surprise. It's like the delight of a riddle, you know. The question gets asked, and you sort of rack your brain and can't think of the answer, and then the answer comes out, and there's this feeling of delight that it fits, but it's so unexpected, you never would have thought of it. So here are a few Dorothy Parker poems that I like. And then I think we'll have time for some conversation or questions if people have any. So, The Flaw in Paganism. The Flaw in Paganism. I just saw there's a pagan celebration today down on the... What is it called?
Courthouse. Courthouse.
It's called... What was it? Pagan...
Pagan Pride Day.
Who knew? So the flaw in paganism. Drink and dance and laugh and lie. Love the reeling midnight through. For tomorrow we shall die. But alas, we never do. Resume. Razors pain you, rivers are damp, acids stain you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't not lawful, nooses give, gas smells awful, you might as well live. And here's comment. Oh, love is a glorious cycle of song, a medley of extemporanea, and love is a thing that can never go wrong, and I am Marie of Romania. And then this is my favorite. This is my mother's favorite, too. I used to read this to her, and she had dementia by then, so she could never remember exactly what it was, you know, but she remembered the first part, and she would always look at me quizzically and go, I like to have a martini. And she could never remember the rest. And so every time I recited this poem to her, she was excited and happy all over again. So I like to have a martini, two at the very most. Three and I'm under the table. Four and I'm under the host. So that's the talk. All right, thank you guys. Yeah.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. We would like to thank LexArts, the Kentucky Foundation for Women, and the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning for supporting these endeavors. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.